Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program today, a continuation of our in-depth investigative reporting on topics ranging from mercury and fluoride and their impact upon our well-being to genetically altered plants and animals. And what we have not been told in the mainstream media would be the effects of consuming these on a regular basis. However, before we go there, and I'm just waiting for one of our guests to sign in with us, let me also address an issue that has not been taken up by the major media. To the contrary, both the television program and People magazine in the current issue have challenged Suzanne Somers, the actress, that she is in effect being irresponsible for taking the approach to her cancer. She had breast cancer. She had a completely orthodox approach to it. She had her diagnosis, surgery, and radiation. So far, in orthodox minds, so good. All the cancer was removed. There is no cancer in her. However, she was then advised to take some combination chemotherapies as a, quote, preventative, unquote. Instead, after doing some research, she chose to try mistletoe and a form of mistletoe called Iscador. That's where the controversy begins. Every single program and each of the interviews that I have at least been made aware of have claimed that there is no proof whatsoever that this mistletoe does anything. In fact, they have marched out the so-called cancer experts who say quackery, nonsense, charlatanism, etc., and advised her would she get back on the path of proven, efficacious, mainstream therapy to save her life and be a model person for other women out there. She is still choosing mistletoe. I would like to, and also they recommended tamoxifen, highly promoting tamoxifen as what she really needs. Unfortunately, none of these journalists or physicians or oncologists took the time to review the actual scientific literature, their literature, and looked at the facts. I would like to share some of this information with you at this time. We're having a technical glitch right now. I'm not sure what that's from. It's in my head, so I'm sure you're hearing this also. We'll see. I'll ask our engineers at BAI to jump on this, please. We have a technical glitch on our program on the ISDN feed line. Hold 1 second, please.
And we will be back to Natural Living with Gary Null in just a moment. We are having a bit of a technical problem right now. We'll ascertain what's going on and then be right back with you. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Natural Living with Gary Null. Please do stay tuned. We'll diagnose this and be right back to you. Stay tuned. Thank you.
wealthy women who took tamoxifen. Page 1318. The result. The results of this study show that tamoxifen can induce potentially malignant changes in the uterus lining. 40% of healthy women who took tamoxifen to prevent breast cancer had histological evidence of endometrial abnormalities compared to 10% of those who took placebo. The British Medical Journal, Volume 308, May 21st. This is an article entitled Prevention Trials with Tamoxifen. This article reports on the temporary interruption of a trial conducted on over 11,000 women that is being tested whether tamoxifen reduces the incidence of breast cancer in women at risk of getting the disease. The trial was interrupted after it was discovered that the same researchers involved in the tamoxifen trial had falsified data in another trial of breast-conserving surgery. According to Cynthia Pearson of the National Women's Health Network, no other preventative treatment carries as much risk as tamoxifen. Available data indicate that the use of tamoxifen for 5 years is associated with a 2% risk of deep venous thrombosis or uterine cancer. This means that out of 8,000 women taking the drug, approximately 100 will suffer major illnesses and 10 to 15 will die from the treatment. The British Medical Journal, Volume 313. Tamoxifen is an anti-estrogenic drug used to prevent breast cancer in healthy women, so it is claimed, who are supposed to be at a higher risk than average of getting cancer. What was shown was that tamoxifen did not actually prevent it. Instead, hot flashes, weight gain, and vaginal discharge occurred in 47% of the women taking tamoxifen, compared to 3% of controls. These symptoms were described as distressing by the patients. The authors highlight the importance of informing patients adequately on the side effects associated with treatment. Preventive Medicine, Volume 27, page 713. The results of this study show that physicians' recommendation as to whether to enroll or not to enroll in a clinical trial of tamoxifen is pivotal in determining the outcome of the patient's decision. Quite simply, a woman was more likely by 13 times to participate in a tamoxifen trial if the doctor advised it. Now, that's just some of the things on tamoxifen. As to the whole idea of the breast cancer and the current paradigms of using chemotherapy, especially in light of all of our promises that we're making greater strides with breast cancer than ever before, and therefore you should stick with the orthodox therapy or you risk your life. The Oncological Journal, Volume 8, page 3, this article highlights that despite claims of great success achieved in breast cancer management, death rates from this disease have changed minimally with the advent of new therapies. And the author also proposes that early surgery may shift the equilibrium of cancer cells towards growth and may therefore promote rather than halt cancer development. The Journal of Clinical Oncology, page 406, and this is in volume 6, the results of the study show that 5-year survival rates in patients with metastatic breast cancer increased from 5% in the 1920s to 25% in the 60s and 25% in the early 70s. But despite the introduction of all these combination drug regimens that they're advocating for Suzanne Summers, the authors conclude, quote, that current treatment modalities failed to improve survival rates of patients with metastatic breast cancer. The Journal of Cancer Research and Clinical Oncology, Volume 114, page 183. An article entitled No Relevant Influence on Overall Survival Time in Patients with Metastatic Breast Cancer Undergoing Combination Chemotherapy. This study reviewed the results of clinical trials conducted between 1975 and 86, evaluating the effects of chemotherapy on survival in women with metastatic breast cancer. It was shown that chemotherapy failed to improve overall survival in patients with late-stage breast cancer. The British Journal of Cancer, Volume 78, page 1418. This study conducted on 155 women with advanced breast cancer receiving chemotherapy who were asked to report their overall sense of well-being before, during, and after treatment. At about 24 weeks, only 26% of the women reported that they felt better after chemotherapy, 19% felt the same, 22% were worse, and the remaining 33% of patients died. The data indicate that three-quarters of women with advanced stage breast cancer experience either no improvement in quality of life or their quality of life worsens when treated with chemotherapy. The Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 271, page 1593. The results of this study show that women with localized breast cancer who undergo intensive diagnostic follow-up after surgery, now that would be Suzanne Summers, fare, quote, no better in terms of progression of disease and overall survival than women who receive regular follow-ups. The study was conducted on 1,243 pre- and post-menopausal women who underwent surgery for breast cancer and had no signs of distant metastasis, who were randomized to receive either normal clinical follow-up consistent of physical examination or intensive chest x-rays and chemotherapy. There was another article also published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, May 5th, 1999, page 1586, reports upon the results of a 10-year follow-up of both patient cohorts, those who received chemotherapy and those who did not. Again, 10 years after primary diagnosis of breast cancer, women who had been followed up intensely showed no survival improvement compared to those who had regular follow-up. And I'll give just a few more. The Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 271, page 1587. The results of the study showed that intensive follow-up for women with early-stage breast cancer does not result in improved survival or improved quality of life. New England Journal of Medicine, Volume 333, page 1444. The results of this meta-analysis of 64 randomized trials involving 28,000 women show that those who received radiation therapy in addition to surgery had lower rates of local tumor reoccurrence but higher 10-year death rates compared to those who receive surgery alone. In particular, radiotherapy was associated with a 6% reduced risk of death from breast cancer, but a 24% increased risk of death from other causes. These results imply that 10 years after treatment, there will be a few extra deaths among women who receive radiation therapy compared to those who did not receive it. It was also shown that more extensive surgery is not associated with a better 10-year survival rate compared with less extensive surgery. The mastectomy had no survival advantages over lumpectomy plus radiation. And I have, by the way, just not to beg the issue, but I have over 60 articles from peer-reviewed journals on randomized clinical trials to show you this. And so on every level, they should be challenged. When they say that chemotherapy is what she needs, then I would show them the New England Journal of Medicine, Volume 343. High-dose chemotherapy and bone marrow transplant for metastatic breast cancer. And this showed that there was not a benefit. In fact, there was a substantial increase risk in complications. The Lancet chemotherapy for high-risk primary breast cancer. This article reports on the results of an on-site review of the clinical records of patients who participated in two studies and did not benefit. So anyhow, for those women who want to know the truth, you're not going to find it in People magazine or on this special on television. Go to the literature. It's there. It's not hidden. So there's three things you want to look at. First, look at tamoxifen. That's what they're promoting, heavy promotion of tamoxifen, because they've been brainwashed. And just look, for instance, at The Lancet, Volume 347, page 1066. The results of this meta-analysis showed that treatment with chemotherapy and tamoxifen is, quote, no better than treatment with tamoxifen alone in improving survival or quality of life. And this was with 4,000 women. And there's also the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, volume 83, page 1013. The results of this study show that the addition of tamoxifen for the prevention of breast cancer in postmenopausal women is not associated with improved survival. Over 1,700 women with breast cancer were randomized to receive that therapy. And The Lancet, volume 343, page 448, the results of this study show that women who used tamoxifen had, for more than 2 years, have a, get this, 2.3-fold increased risk of uterine cancer compared to non-users. And there's tamoxifen therapy for breast cancer and endometrial cancer risk, according to the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, volume 91, page 1654. The results of this study show that breast cancer patients treated with tamoxifen have an overall 50% increased risk of endometrial cancer compared to those who did not take the drug. The risk increased with duration of treatment, and women who took tamoxifen for 5 or more years had a 4-fold increased risk of endometrial cancer compared to non-users. And the Gynecological Oncology, volume 73, page 21, showed that the results of the study show that tamoxifen can induce specific changes in the uterus lining, including enlargement of endometrial glands and endometrial polyps. And there's a whole lot of studies just on this. Look at the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, volume 180. The report shows that in a case group of women, tamoxifen-induced endometrial polyps evolved to endometrial cancer. From Breast Cancer Research and Treatment, volume 53, page 271, the results of this study showed the use of tamoxifen for 5 or more years associated with a 50% increased risk of colorectal cancer compared to non-use. The British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology, volume 45, page 608, the study showed that women with a history of breast cancer currently taking tamoxifen have a 7-fold, that's a 700% increased risk of developing deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism compared to women with a history of breast cancer who never used the drug. And just two more, the Bulletin of Cancer Research, volume 82, page 51. The results of this study conducted on 441 postmenopausal women with breast cancer showed that tamoxifen-associated thromboembolic complications occurred in 4.3% of them and were fatal in 2 cases. Annals of Oncology, volume 7, page 245, the study evaluated the effects of adding low-dose prednisone and chemotherapy treatment to patients with breast cancer. The addition of steroid prednisone allowed delivery of higher dose of chemotherapy, 12% higher. Overall 13-year survival in patients receiving prednisone and high-dose chemotherapy was 59%, but those that did not, 65%. The aggressive treatment did not work. Now, that's only one part, and that's merely a sampling of the articles I have. All told, I have over 500 articles. Here's the point. If I can find 500 articles in mainstream cancer and medical journals to show that chemotherapy after surgery and radiation does not benefit, increases the problems a person could have, that tamoxifen is one of the most dangerous drugs possible for women, that the efficacy on it has not been proven, and the safety is also shown to be a major complication, then why not allow a person to have that opportunity to use whatever they want? Now, she was using mistletoe. Would I suggest a person use just mistletoe? No. I would suggest an entire program, a program that might have 40 different things, plus intravenous vitamin C and ozone and chelation therapy and elimination diet. But that's my perspective. But when they said that there's no scientific evidence supporting mistletoe, they were wrong again. Because, again, I'm going to my clinician's handbook of natural therapy. And just let me read a few items here. Again, under cancer, there's a study published in Molecular Biology and Hematology on a study of patients with tumors using mistletoe. And, quote, results showed that significant differences were found between the groups using the lectins, which is mistletoe, in immunomodulation from the Anti-Cancer Research, volume 14. Again, immunomodulation. She's doing this to build up her immune system so she doesn't get cancer again. That's reasonable. There's an article in Anti-Cancer Research, Volume 10, Anti-Cancer Research, Volume 12 on mistletoe. There's German studies in at least 7 different journals in Germany showing, in mainstream scientific journals in Germany, showing mistletoe works. Cancer Letters, that's a mainstream publication. Quote, this study isolated a tumor-reducing component from mistletoe extract, Iscador, and identified to be a peptide of approximately molecular weight 5,000. The isolated peptide reduced the solid tumor incidence by Dalton's lymphoma ascites tumor cells in mice and were highly cytotoxic to the DLA cells, but was not cytotoxic to normal lymphocytes, indicating a cell-dependent specificity. Now, that's just, I'm reading just some of the scientific background on just one. Now, on the peer review journal Oncology, volume 43, page 42, this review article notes that mistletoe extracts have been found to possess significant anti-tumor activity in vivo against murine tumors and carcinoma, lung, and breast. How many do I have on just mistletoe and its anti-cancer impact? Over 30 articles that I was able to get in under an hour. And I didn't have more time than that to spend, or I could have, and showing that it builds up the immune competence. So is it reasonable to assume that someone who wants to not get cancer again and wants to do something, albeit certainly not comprehensive and not complete, but something to help themselves, has taken a step in the right direction? If anything, had any of these journalists taken the time and effort to read the scientific literature, they would have found that her rejection of chemotherapy was one of the best things she could have done because it's based upon the scientific literature, not a mass hysterical belief that is not supported by facts. Her suggestion that mistletoe may provide her immune system with a boost is absolutely scientifically correct. Unfortunately, the editors and the producers either were A, ignorant, or intentionally disingenuous, because what we do not know is what they selectively chose not to report. That's just to give a little follow-up. But time does not allow me to go further. I've not been able to get my other guest, so we'll go to our original guest who's been patiently standing by to talk about mercury fillings. He is Dr. Charles Williamson. Dr. Williamson was internship and residency at the University of Pennsylvania. After practicing mainstream orthodox medicine, he slowly broadened his scope and training in complementary healing and became co-medical director of the Anti-Aging Institute and the American Anti-Aging Foundation. And he's been involved with grassroots efforts to stop the use of mercury dental amalgams, and he sees and treats patients with mercury and other heavy metal poisonings. And he practices integrative medicine in Boca Raton, Florida. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm happy to be here.
I never assumed that any guest would want to be hearing any of my comments before I go on. You have an opportunity, if you choose, before we do our interview, to challenge any of the statements I just made.
No, the only comment I would make is that I have to refer patients to Germany, to a clinic there that uses the mistletoe.
Oh.
Because I can't find too many people here in the United States.
All right. The American Dental Association advocated the use of mercury amalgam fillings for decades. Now it has, in effect, officially reversed its position on this issue. What did the American Dental Association say about mercury fillings most recently?
They've begun to slowly introduce, not unlike the tobacco companies, that maybe there is something to this issue of toxicity. There is a report in one of the major journals on this that recently just came out. Are you aware of this journal article? I think it was in JAMA. I'm not sure.
No, I'm not.
Yes, and they are slowly starting to. Let's say, tread water, and note that there may be something, but they're still not accepting any responsibility for it. In fact, they have divorced themselves from the responsibility in an action in California several years ago, where they stated categorically through their attorneys that they have no culpability. It's strictly up to the dentist and the patient.
Well, that's rather clever, because they also were behind the legislation in California that, unique to California, If you advocated as a dentist to remove the mercury filling, you could be brought up on charges of practicing unscientific dentistry.
Yes, it is paradoxical, isn't it?
So
they tell one thing on one hand and then they say something else, but that is on the for public record their statement that they have no responsibility whatsoever.
I'd like for you to take us on a journey now, if you would please. What are the different problems, both physical and mental, that have been linked not just with memory, some people will neurological problems, memory, low IQ, ADD, but all the other ways that we are exposed to mercury that could be imbalancing us, whether it's hormones or kidney function? And tell us why mercury fillings can be removed by qualified dentists. With what substances should they be replaced, and how durable and effective are those replacements compared to mercury in preventing tooth decay?
Sure. Well, let me start by talking about the most common signs and symptoms. That's how physicians refer to it. Symptoms being what the patient presents to the physician complaining about, and the signs being what the physician can actually see objectively in the patient. There are quite a few here, and I'll touch on some, and if you think I'm taking too long, just interrupt me. Mercury is definitely shown to damage sperm, lowers the sperm count and motility, causes menstrual disturbances, spontaneous abortions. It is involved in cardiovascular damage with dilated cardiomyopathies, can cause tachycardia, dysrhythmias, hypertension, and also increases the risk of heart attack. Definitely related to allergies, asthma, chronic fatigue. It destroys your intestinal lining, can result in the leaky gut syndrome. Hormonal imbalance is incredible because it goes right to the pituitary, which is the master gland. And from there on, you can talk about thyroid, you can talk about the ovaries, you can talk about many of the endocrine system's hormones being out of balance. Autoimmune diseases, lupus, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, autism, schizophrenia, eczema, psoriasis, candidiasis, severe kidney disease, depression, suicidal ideation, anger, obsessive-compulsive traits, strongly related to multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's, related to osteoporosis, and of course, lowers the IQ. Chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, fainting, blurred vision, headaches, these are all some of the things patients can present with. Unexplained anxiety, irritability, hostility, aggression, insomnia, restlessness, difficulty concentrating and thinking, forgetfulness, word recall difficulty, crying spells, tinnitus, that's a ringing in the ears, sinus congestion, frequent sneezing, hoarseness, an itchy feeling in the throat, flushing of the skin, loss of appetite, chronic obesity, painful menstruation, joint pains, gait disturbances, tremors, weakness, and swelling of the limbs. And that's just a few.
Okay, now, I'd like you to give us the support for those so that we know that these are not just your opinion, but there's evidence that can back
well,
these up.
Let me sum this up by saying it's the same as you just said in your previous statements when you were talking about tamoxifen. You can't get it out of People Magazine or Time, what have you. But I can give you a website, which is Dr. Boyd Haley's website, and there are probably 1,000 scientific journal articles on there, many of them by Dr. Haley himself, who is probably the world's leading expert in mercury toxicity from amalgams. That website is altcorp.com. And all of these things that I have spoken about here are documented in the scientific literature. Many of them have been peer-reviewed, as you mentioned earlier.
Could you give that to us again so we can have it?
Certainly. A, as in Albert, L as in Larry, T as in Tom, C as in Charlie, O as in old, R as in radiograph, and let's see, where am I? Oh, P as in Paul.com.
Okay. Let's continue on then.
You were asking about replacing fillings. The holistic mercury-free biologic dentists, as they are called, offer several things for replacing mercury amalgams. These include space-age plastics, the acrylics, And polymers also offer porcelain and enamel. And these are the mainstays at the present time. And they work quite well. Some of them, they say, do not last as long as the amalgams, but then they're not toxic either. They cost more, and that's always been one of the Dental Association's problems with it, is that they cost more than the mercury amalgams do.
One of the side effects of mercury toxicity is depression. Consequently, dentists have the highest suicide rate of all professions. How do mercury levels in dentists compare to mercury levels, let's say, in other people? And what is the link between exposure to mercury and health problems in dentists?
I see and treat dentists, although they've asked me to keep it very confidential, and of course do. But what I have seen in these people from testing them with objective measuring devices is that they have severe cognitive problems. They have motor problems, meaning that they frequently present with tremors. But using a baseline study, that machine that we use to measure the biomarkers of aging, one of them being cognitive and short-term memory ability, these people that I have tested that work in dental offices or dentists themselves score in the 10 or 15 percentile of the subjects that were used to develop this study, 25,000 people. So that, to me, tells me something, that they really are cognitively impaired when they score that low. They also, as with regards to the end of your question, how much time happens or occurs in between exposure and disease, it's really an individual thing. I frequently tell patients that mercury poisoning can often be very insidious, not unlike hypertension. It slips up on you. And then, too, you go to traditional docs, and they're looking for every other reason because they never really have been exposed to the issue of mercury toxicity. You didn't get it in medical school. You didn't get it in your internship or residency. So they want to pin another reason for that particular complaint.
Appreciate that answer. What sort of test should a person undergo before having mercury fillings removed?
Well, there's a lot of controversy about that at the present time. I have spent time with Dr. Haley, and we have tried to come up with a reasonable protocol for this. And again, it's somewhat uncharted waters. There's really no FDA-approved process for this, but... And a lot of people, the chemical that we use is DMPS, which is a chelator of mercury, goes into the body and binds and brings the mercury out primarily through the renal system, through the kidneys. The other route of elimination is fecal, through the gastrointestinal tract. But some people do apparently have allergies to the DMPS. I have not had that happened in my patient load, but nevertheless, there are reports in the literature of some allergies to DMPS. However, the alternatives are very few. There's the DMSA, which is an oral chelator, and then there's the chlorella and N-acetylcysteine and a number of over-the-counter products that you can get at health food stores that will help. However, I don't really recommend this to be done, particularly if a person has quite a few amalgams in the mouth. You need to establish a baseline renal function on the person, because if you're going to suddenly detox them and bring a lot of mercury out through the kidneys, and they already have renal clearance problems, you could put them into a acute kidney failure. So it's imperative that you have this checked first. To make a challenge test on the patient after that, we use a lab in Chicago that measures total body load of mercury and tries to give us a guideline as to whether or not we are affecting treatment. When we look at it again down the road after treating the patient, we can see mercury levels going down. And that's the best we have at this point in time.
What about the individual goes to their dentist and the dentist says, once that filling is solid, It's not going to leak. There's no vapor going anywhere in your body. It doesn't matter what you chew, hot, cold, doesn't matter. How would you respond?
My response is that that person is has his head or her head buried in the sand, that they're ignoring the scientific literature. Dr. Lorscheider in Calgary has already demonstrated that, and also Dr. Haley, that mercury vapor is constantly being released from these amalgams, and the more that you stimulate it by chewing hot beverages, brushing, polishing, the more it is liberated. And that the vapor itself takes nanoseconds to cross into the cells or into the bloodstream, where it has a half-life in the bloodstream of about 3 seconds before it's gone into tissue. So I'd say they're ignoring the facts.
Well, I certainly appreciate you sharing the facts with us and coming on the air, and people will go to that website. And if people would like to contact you, do you have a number?
Sure. It's area code 561-883-3034.
Very much appreciate you being on with us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gary.
Bye. Dr. Charles Williamson, medical doctor. Let's go now over to our next panelist. He is standing by. He is Dr. Michael Fox. And Dr. Fox is a psychologist, professor, veterinarian, and bioethicist who, since 1982, has been a leader in the movement for ethical treatment of animals. He earned his degrees from the University of London and Royal Veterinary College in England. He is the author of more than 40 books on animal-related topics, including Beyond Evolution and Eating with Conscience. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Fox. You there?
Good to be with you, too. I've long admired your program. You really get to the essence of things.
Thank you. A recent article in the New York Post claimed that people who were speaking out about genetically engineered foods were using scare tactics. In fact, I have the article here with me just so people say, see, I'm not talking out of context. I'll actually read the first paragraph. And this is by Dean Kleckner. And it says, Patagonia, maker of environmentally conscious sportswear, an enemy of conventional agriculture, has issued a Chicken Little alert to its customers over genetically modified crops. Employing the usual bad science and scare tactics, the trendy clothing manufacturer is calling these crops, quote, a dark threat to all that is wild, unquote. Instead of making use of proven new methods that have fed billions of hungry people, Patagonia is urging its customers to, quote, go organic. Only certified organic food is guaranteed to be free of genetically engineered ingredients, unquote. Consumers are used to Patagonia's latching on to fashionable environmental causes to sell $110 fleece pullovers, but these latest publicity campaign comes at a particularly critical time in the debate over biotechnology. With the support of the farm community, the North Dakota legislature is currently weighing a bill that would impose a 2-year moratorium on the planting of genetically modified wheat. Farmers are quick to point out that their support isn't based upon principle. Half the soybeans and cotton American farmers plant every year are genetically modified, after all, but on fear. The global propaganda campaign against biotechnology, aided and abetted by the capitalist-cum-fear mongers of Patagonia, has convinced them that their exports to Europe and Japan will suffer if North Dakota wheat is grown from genetically modified seeds. And then it goes on to, in effect, denigrate everything that would be a challenge to the genetically modified model. First, I'd like for you to respond to that.
Gary, it's about the best synopsis of the lies, myths, and promises that are being made to support the genetic engineering of our food. And the author, of course, he is chairman of Truth About Trade and Technology, and he's past president of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Now, those who know about agribusiness know that the American Farm Bureau Federation is not out there to protect the family farm, but to promote the interests of agribusiness. And we're all very concerned about the contaminated corn, the so-called Starlink corn that was first found in tacos and so on. And it was only approved for feeding to livestock, which is questionable, this genetically engineered corn. You check up who developed this. It's a company called Aventis Corporation, and Aventis Corporation is the second largest producer and distributor of pesticides in the world, and is one of the largest owners of seed stock. So we have vested interests here, all out to claim that without genetically engineered crops, millions of people are going to be suffering, and if we even question this new technology, we're anti-humanitarian. And these are the myths, lies, and promises that I've addressed in this new book, Beyond Evolution. It's a great concern to me because I am, by training, a veterinarian and a scientist. And it's essentially bad science that's been put out to genetically engineer our food. The main motive being that once a seed variety has been genetically engineered, they can say that it's unique and can be patented. Then there's a shift towards controlling more and more the global food production system. But the scientists and the lawyers say, well, even though it is unique and can be patented, these genetically engineered crops and foods are substantially equivalent to conventional crops. Therefore, they don't need to be labeled to inform consumers in the marketplace whether or not the food or beverages that they're buying contain genetically engineered ingredients.
Let's take a... I appreciate the answer. Thank you. Since the introduction of genetically altered foods into our food supply, we get occasional news reports about how certain companies were found to have genetically altered ingredients in their products. One example is the corn you mentioned used in the Taco Bell shells. Another was with a well-known vegetarian food manufacturer. And other reports, however, say that up to 60% of all processed foods now contain some form of genetically engineered ingredients. If the percentage is so high, why are we confronted only with the occasional news report? And also, to what degree are food manufacturers required to inform consumers when there are genetically engineered ingredients in their products?
This is quite a series of questions. And I started monitoring what was going on in this area around about 1986-87. And during the time since then to today, various consumer groups, civil society organizations, farmers, agricultural groups, and so on, have petitioned the government to have all genetically engineered food ingredients, additives, supplements, and so forth labeled so that the consumer right to know will be respected and upheld by the government. But the government has dodged this. The role of government has been since the Bush administration, the former Bush administration, and Dan Quayle's Competitiveness Council was to put agricultural biotechnology on a fast track so that the multinationals who are currently based in America can very rapidly develop their market niches internationally to sell their products. So essentially what we have has been a series of steps by the government to put this technology on fast track without any regulations and without any informing of the public. Field trials of these crops have been done in various parts of the country, and I was predicting years ago that what you're going to get from these genetically engineered crops is their pollen spreading to other crops, to conventional crops, to organic crops, and to wild-related plants, and all hell could break loose. For example, a lot of these genetically engineered crops, like the corn and soybean, have been engineered to resist certain herbicides. And now the pollen is being spread to wild varieties, and these can become superweeds. Some of the genetically engineered crops produce their own insecticides, called BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. This is killing beneficial insects, monarch butterflies, and could even be killing off birds who eat insects who are full of these toxins. This is another step towards the destruction of wildlife and the loss of biodiversity. And agricultural scientists are now showing that when you have good biodiversity and you don't have these so-called monocrops or monocultures, you have a healthier farming ecology, and it's even an antidote to global warming. But this technology is pushing forward now to create what I'm calling a biological wasteland. And this genetic pollution is very, very serious. One farmer in Canada had his crop genetically contaminated by a neighbor farmer who was raising Monsanto's genetically engineered variety. And he lost his case in court. Monsanto claimed that, in fact, this man had stolen some of the genetically engineered seeds, while the man was saying, no, these are crossbred from the previous year, and I'm stuck now with a totally contaminated crop. Now, a lot of countries are saying no to the importation of these genetically engineered soybean, corn, canola, and other products because of the potential hazards. And there have been no safety tests done on whether this is okay for consumers, for pregnant women. Animal studies have been very few and far between. And the one major animal study was done by a friend of mine, Dr. Arat Putsai, for the United Kingdom government. He fed some genetically engineered potatoes to young rodents, and they developed very serious signs of internal developmental abnormalities, especially affecting their intestines, raising the question, very serious question, are these new products safe? And the question that I ask is, do we really need these new genetically engineered products in the first place? No, we don't, unless you are a multinational corporation looking to lock in on a global control of the world food market. And that's where it's going, Gary.
You coined the term human animal, and it refers to animals that have been genetically engineered to contain some human genes. Why are they produced, and what is the likelihood that they'll be utilized?
They are being utilized. The first to be produced were mice that were implanted with human growth genes, and they grew twice as big, twice as large. And then the U.S. Department of Agriculture researchers put human genes into pigs, and they became severely crippled. They didn't grow twice as big, twice as fast. The hope was to produce pigs twice as quickly, twice as big, to make them more efficient producers. Human genes are being put into a whole variety of animals to produce new pharmaceuticals in their milk. The Dutch had a bull called Herman who carries the gene that will alter the cow's milk to make it more human-like. They're putting human genes into pigs to turn them into blood and organ donors. So these are totally unnatural creatures carrying human genes, hence I call them humanimals. We're really profoundly interfering with creation. And where is the sense of reverence for life and respect for the integrity of creation here? We cross all boundaries, and the bottom line is not human health or progress. It's profits, profits, profits.
What do you see as the global consequences of genetically engineered plants and animals?
Seriously contaminated ecosystems. When you think of radioactive plutonium, it has a half-life of about 40,000 years. Think of a genetically engineered organism that has never been on the planet before, that can spread its genetic material, its reconstructed DNA, to other species. This is called horizontal transfer. And it's been proven that plants can transmit this to insects and to other creatures. Even the bacteria in our mouths can pick up transgenic reconstructed DNA, genetic material, from food that we eat. The specter is very, very serious. The probability of ecological catastrophes, serious health problems and so on, about which we know nothing yet and will be very, very difficult to trace, ranging from allergies to new toxins in crops that are genetically unstable. This is a Pandora's box situation. And the bottom line is, do we really need this technology? Is it really going to feed the hungry world? Now, some advocates, like the people with the Rockefeller Institute in New York, are saying that this is the way to feed the hungry world. It's the second green revolution. the doubly green revolution, applying this new technology on top of pesticides and high-yield varieties. But I work with my wife in India, and we know there that the traditional crops and the diversity of agricultural practices were sustainable, organic, and the way to feed the hungry world is with their local varieties. But the intellectual property rights of these peoples are being eroded by the multinational corporations, essentially forcing them under contract and through government coercion to raise these new genetically engineered crops with the pesticide and herbicide packages, primarily for export. And it's going to actually aggravate local malnutrition and hunger amongst the poor.
Can you explain how bioengineered foods can infiltrate the organic produce market?
Well, this is another problem here. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I was working on the national organic standards, were trying to put genetically engineered crops under the organic umbrella, saying that, you know, genes are natural, so it's okay. But there were 280,000 letters went back to the USDA saying genetically engineered products don't belong under the organic label. But they can still get in there through genetic pollution. One major producer from Texas of high-quality, organically certified corn chips had them pulled off the market in Europe and lost hundreds of thousands of dollars because they were found to be genetically contaminated from being fertilized by the pollen from a corn producer who is raising genetically engineered corn nearby. We also have the problem that even on the shelf when we go and buy our milk, if it's not organically certified, it probably contains milk from cows that have been injected with genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. For human health reasons, the British government has outlawed this product. And for humane reasons, the Canadian government has said no to their dairy farmers injecting cows with this recombinant genetically engineered hormone. But the U.S. government has refused to have the milk and other dairy products from cows injected with this hormone labeled to inform consumers. So the bottom line is go and buy organically certified.
All right. The media in the United States is not as critical of genetic engineering as the media in other countries. Therefore, our citizens are not aware, as those in other countries, of the hazards of genetic engineered food. In Canada, for example, there was a huge outcry against the use of bovine growth hormone, and the people were successful at keeping the hormone out of their milk supply. How have the governments of other countries responded to America's use of genetically engineered foods?
Well, I'm afraid it has shocked America. It's disturbed many, many farmers. There are tests now to actually identify whether a shipment of soybean contains some genetically engineered seeds. And there has been very inadvertent mixing of conventional and genetically engineered commodity crops for export to Europe and other countries. And now they're starting to run tests, and it's going to boil into a much worse trade war than you could ever imagine, because informed consumers in other countries don't want this food. Number one, because there is no scientific evidence that the food is safe. And number two, there's probability of significant risk for people, new allergies, possibly new toxins. And we have problems with the gene expression in these genetically engineered crops, so that certain substances like the insect toxins could be much, much higher levels and have adverse effects on the farmer's soil. It's been shown that this BT toxin can leak into the soil from the plant's roots, killing vital microorganisms in the soil. So the ecological impact is concerning many more enlightened countries, as well as the consumer risks and the impact on wildlife, including wild birds and beneficial insects.
How many experiments do you think have gone wrong? Will we one day, 5 or 10 years from now, hear from whistleblowers who are no longer with a company that, gee, yeah, our company was doing some genetically engineering and we ended up having a virus that had never been seen before and it devastated something? How do we know that there are not some real horror stories that simply haven't gotten into our media yet?
Well, there have been a lot of horror stories with the cloning of animals and the multiple defects. And that dirty laundry came out when the animal cloners said no to human cloning. And that's the old double standard again. We can clone animals and create all kinds of defects, but the human is somehow still more sacred than other creatures. And that's the kind of human-centered attitude that is at the root of many of our global and local social problems. My philosophy is one of equalitarianism, of treating all living beings with equal and fair consideration. But when we get into this business of just putting new genes into organisms, some scientists have demonstrated how a more lethal virus can be created after genetically engineering it. It happened in Australia recently, where a scientist was playing around with a not very harmful mouse pox virus, and he put an additional gene into this virus and made it lethal to mice. So it was a big surprise. Some of the genetically engineered viruses that are put into plants to carry genes, the virus infects a whole plant, and that's how the genes spread in the plant. These viruses can recombine with so-called endogenous viruses in the plants, creating new plant diseases. So it is a Pandora's box situation. Hmm. And
I appreciate
scientists
you.
Know this.
I appreciate
so you. We must adopt the precautionary principle.
If people want more information, do you have a website?
I don't have a website, but they can call the publisher for the introductory book on Beyond Evolution. There's a fax, 212-929-1836. And for the general book, Eating with Conscience, which is for activists and deals with genetically engineered foods, that is distributed by Publishers Group West. And the phone number for that is 1-800-788-3123. That's 1-800-788-3123.
Very much appreciate being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
Dr. Michael Fox. We're out of time. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, Perkin number 2744. And I am still in the midst of my ongoing in-depth investigation on the facts behind the Pacifica and BAI. When that information is finally evolved to where I feel confident to share it in an objective way, that will be done. Have a good day, everyone.